And for the rest of this hour, a collective sigh of relief for all those who can't imagine life without the Hubble telescope. After much to-ing and fro-ing, the Hubble has been granted another life extension. Earlier this week, NASA Administrator Michael Griffin announced that rather than let the Hubble die a slow death, NASA would mount a shuttle mission to repair and upgrade the telescope. Joining me now to talk about it is my guest, Stephen Beckwith. He's the former director of the Space Telescope Science Institute and a professor of physics and astronomy at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He joins me by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Beckwith.
Thank you, Joe.
So first, I think we should let people know, oh, by the way, people who want to ask you questions about this Hubble Space Telescope and the repair mission and what we can expect afterwards and what we can look forward to in the meantime, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK and OK. Now, the question I was going to ask you is, why is this repair mission so essential, because Hubble's still working today?
Well, it's essential because there are parts of the telescope that wear out, just like any other machine. And the two crucial parts we worry about are the batteries that supply power to keep the telescope warm and the gyroscopes that allow us to point the telescope anywhere in the sky. And the batteries are the same batteries that were installed at launch in 1990, so they're now 16 years old. And just like the batteries in your PC or even your car battery, they wear out after they've been recharged many times. And without them, the telescope will literally freeze up and die. So that's the crucial pit that has to be changed. But the gyroscopes also wear out. They spin. They're the most precise gyroscopes ever made, and they typically have lifetimes of 3 or 4 years. There are 6 gyroscopes, and you need 3 to point the telescope well, but we've learned how to point the telescope pretty well, at least a part of the sky, with a fewer than 3. And we're down to 4 gyroscopes now, and we estimate that we'll lose another gyroscope or two in the next couple of years. So without a replacement, we won't really be able to use the telescope to do science.
Is there any concern that things will break down too fast, and that by the time the repair mission gets there, which I gather is sometime in 2008, it'll be too late?
No, we worried about that with the batteries. I think the only thing that's really critical to keep the telescope alive are the batteries, and that's because when the telescope, every 96 minutes it goes around the Earth, and about a third of that time it's in the shadow behind, in the night side of the Earth. And during that time, we need to put power into the telescope to keep it warm. And if we don't do that, it will freeze up, the truss will warp in ways that we don't even want to contemplate. And so we do that by charging the batteries through sunlight on the light side and then discharging the batteries and heating it on the dark side. So if the batteries really fail to hold charge, the telescope will freeze up in a matter of just a few days. And we worried about that a lot because they are the originals, but we've done tests over the last 2 years. They've changed the charging cycle, and the recent tests show there has been no loss of charge capacity over the last 2 years, and now we're really pretty confident they'll work fine. They'll keep the telescope safe until 2010, mm-hmm. So we have plenty of leeway. The other things that could wear out, like the gyroscopes, even in the worst case where we lost all the gyroscopes, although we wouldn't be able to do science, there would be no real danger to the telescope. So it could orbit happily up there until the astronauts visit it and swap out the new equipment.
But if it can last to 2010, isn't that long enough? Or when does the...
Oh, yeah. No, that should be plenty. I mean, even if there are delays in the next mission, we're pretty confident the telescope will be perfectly safe. And frankly, we think that luck has favored us as the well-prepared. I think the telescope will be doing science, first-rate science, right up until the time of the servicing mission right now. There's an indication that our gyroscopes are, the current gyroscopes are lasting longer than the first sets that we used to put in.
Okay. Well, one thing I think maybe people always wondered, and maybe it's just good to remind them, is why is it important to have a telescope orbiting from space? And can it do things that, is it completely better than anything on Earth, or is it just better in some ways?
Well, I'm a bit you know, I'm a bit of a Hubble hugger here, but yes, it is completely better than every other telescope. It's the most powerful telescope in the world, and even though it's not the biggest telescope, the lack of atmosphere, or rather the freedom of, you know, just observing the light unimpeded by the atmosphere, gives it a tremendous additional power over anything we can build from the Earth. And there are really three problems that you have from an Earth-bound telescope looking through the atmosphere. The first is that the atmosphere only transmits some wavelengths and not all wavelengths. So the critical wavelengths in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum and many wavelengths in the infrared part of the spectrum, the atmosphere blocks completely. So for the space telescope, we can see everything, and that's quite important for many kinds of science. The second thing that the atmosphere does is it distorts light, and anyone who goes out at night and looks up in the sky and sees the stars twinkling recognizes that it's the atmosphere that really causes that distortion. And on a windy night, it looks even much worse. So that distortion sets a fundamental floor limit to what you can really resolve from the ground, and Hubble overcomes that, of course, by being in space. And then the third problem that most people don't think about is the atmosphere itself does glow. And so for a lot of the wavelengths that Hubble observes at, if it were on the ground, it would be a lot like trying to observe during the daytime. You know, the sky itself is tremendously bright, especially in the infrared. So by getting outside of the atmosphere, you just open all of that up. And it means that as far as sensitivity, taking the deepest photographs, the most sensitive images ever, Hubble still beats the largest telescopes on the ground by quite a bit. We can't even follow up some of the discoveries on the ground just because Hubble is so much more sensitive. It's about 10 billion times as sensitive as the unaided human eye.
All right. Well, Hubble hugger. I like that. It scans nicely. Let's hear what some of our listeners have to say. And first, let's go to Chris in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Chris, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering, I mean, when you have something as historic as something like the Hubble or Skylab, why couldn't they just, you know, add enough fuel to it while it's in orbit, while they're up there, to put it in a slow orbit around the sun? Why let something like Hubble burn up in the first place? I know we're getting a reprieve now, but... you know, later on, why not, you know, if it comes back in 500 years, what do I care?
Yeah, okay.
So why let it burn up?
All right, Chris, good question. Maybe Dr. Beckwith, what about that?
Well, Chris, I love you. There's no real reason that Hubble has to re-enter the atmosphere. And typically when the astronauts visit it, they reboost it. It doesn't take very much. So right now, if there's no reboost at all, it will not re-enter the atmosphere until about 2025, I think, with a very modest reboost. That is just boosting it up about 10 or 15 kilometers. It will stay up there for much longer than that. So there's an advantage to the orbit that it's in, and that advantage is the space shuttle can reach it and therefore can not just repair it but can upgrade it. That will be the biggest advance from the next servicing mission will be the new instruments. But really, Hubble could live for a long time, and frankly, I don't think we have anything in the planning stages that will surpass Hubble in over most of its wavelength range. And so I believe it will be competitive for at least another decade and possibly beyond. And whether or not they want to keep operating it will be a decision some future NASA administrator will have to take.
So in other words, as I understood it, at least at some point, they do have to do something affirmative to make it re-enter the atmosphere in a way that it won't land on people, or won't by chance land on people. Could they also boost it into an orbit so that it would never come back to Earth at all on this mission? Because
they could do it on this mission, but that's always an option. They studied that option some time ago, and they concluded that, see, NASA is a pretty risk-averse agency in some ways, and it would be relatively easy to put it into an orbit in which it would last 100 or 200 years, but even that isn't enough. I think they require, if you're going to leave anything up there, it has to be up there for at least 10,000 years, and that turns out to be harder than it is to just push it down into the atmosphere. It's not just a useful scientific device, but it's one that's very much loved by the public, and I think has kept a lot of public support and enthusiasm for astronomy over the last decade. If it continues to do that, it's a benefit to everyone, and they may well decide just to give it modest reboosts from time to time and keep it up for a while.
But at $1 billion a pop, I guess that's going to be a pretty big commitment.
Well, it's, you know, it's not $1 billion. The $1 billion is the worst, or I would say the most extreme estimate of the transportation costs, because the shuttle program costs about $4 billion a year, and typically they get about four shuttle flights. Once you have a shuttle program or any kind of a program that can service satellites at all, most of the cost is just in the infrastructure of the program. The marginal cost of extra flights is not very high. So the cost of building Hubble to begin with was $4.3 billion. And every time we've serviced it and put new instruments on, it's like a whole new observatory. We get typically 10 to 50 times the additional observing capacity with these new instruments. And so that's a real bargain compared to what it would cost to build a new Hubble and put it up with new instruments every time.
Got it. Okay, let's take another call from one of our listeners. How about Janil? Did I say that right? In Miami, Florida?
Hey, yes, Janil.
Yeah.
Garcia.
Hi.
Well, I love the Hubble just as much as the next person, but I'm a progressive thinker, and I was just wondering when or what are the plans for a telescope that's just as powerful or even better than the Hubble?
Okay.
Or anything like that in the works?
All right.
Well, there are telescopes in the works which will go well beyond what Hubble can do over certain parts of its wavelength range. The one that is planned now for launch in 2013 is the James Webb Space Telescope, and that will be a 6.5-meter telescope. Hubble is a 2.4-meter diameter telescope.
Those meters to refer to the size of the mirror, the
diameter
collector.
Of the mirror. Yeah.
Right, okay.
It's actually a much bigger facility.
Mm-hmm.
Hubble is about the size of a school bus,
mm-hmm.
and it weighs about 25,000 pounds, so it's like a large school bus. James Webb will be larger still. And it will not be in low Earth orbit. It will be out in deep space, about 1 million miles away. And that will be much more powerful than Hubble over the infrared range. But actually, the wavelength range of the James Webb will not overlap very much with Hubble's wavelength range. So it won't really be a replacement for Hubble. And right now, there isn't anything on the drawing boards or in the planning stages that will replace Hubble's critical, a visible and ultraviolet capability for the foreseeable future. So Hubble is it for now.
Hmm. We're talking with Stephen Beckwith, the former director of the Space Telescope Science Institute, about the upcoming, I guess it's upcoming now, Hubble Space Telescope repair mission. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call now and go to, here we go, let's go to Todd in Cincinnati, Ohio. Let's get out of Florida. Todd, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my call. My question is, the past NASA administrator had decided not to save Hubble, and now we get the new administrator in to go up and save it. What's the chances by the time the saving program is put in place that someone else couldn't come along and say, well, we're going to scrap this policy and not save it at all when it comes down to the end of the day? And not save it at all.
Kind of a gloomy question there, Todd, but
well,
probably a legitimate one.
My belief about space politics is that your mission is never really safe until it's on the launch pad and they've actually lit the fuse.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can at least, assuming everything was planned correctly, you can at least breathe a sigh of relief. So certainly, Todd, it is possible that a future administrator might cancel the mission to Hubble, although, you know, the planning right now is to carry out this mission in May of 2008, unless President Bush is unhappy with Dr. Griffin, and I don't see why he would be. Michael Griffin's doing a marvelous job as administrator of NASA. Mr. Griffin will still be, or Dr. Griffin will still be in charge when Hubble is serviced. Now, there can be delays and there can be politics, so it's always possible, but I think the motivation that Mr. O'Keefe, the previous NASA administrator, gave for not servicing Hubble was based on his notion of the safety of a Hubble mission. But he hadn't really done the full-up probabilistic risk analysis, and when that was done, they concluded that it really isn't any more dangerous to fly to Hubble than to fly to the station. So I believe as long as we've got a space shuttle fleet going up there, flying to Hubble will be considered a very desirable and a very doable mission.
Okay. I think probably we haven't really talked about the other things that are going to happen on this mission besides the gyroscopes and the batteries. There are some new instruments being carried up, isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the thing that's really interesting, most people aren't aware of it. They think of these servicing missions as kind of like fixing your car. But really what we do on each mission is we install new instruments, and because of the advance of technology, the instruments typically give improvements in observing capability of enormous factors. In the case of the upcoming one, there will be two new instruments, the Cosmic Origin Spectrograph. That'll be about 20 times as powerful as its predecessor, and the Wide Field Camera 3, and that will be between 10 and 50 times as powerful as its predecessor, anything up there now, in different bands. And so you get a whole new observatory. I mean, it's really, Hubble will then be at the peak of its powers. It will be more powerful than it's ever been. And the kinds of capabilities it had are perfectly set up for what I would call the big four astrophysics questions of the day: the study of dark energy, study of dark matter, characterization of extrasolar planetary systems, and the study of the first stars and galaxies after the Big Bang. So you can expect that Hubble will churn out discoveries at a rate just as high as it has in the past after this next servicing mission. And that's what's so unique about this. It's not so much the maintenance, but it's the upgrades that give it a whole new characteristics.
All right. Well, I guess we'll look forward to reporting on that mission when it comes up in a couple years, and I guess we'll call you back afterwards and see how it went.
We're all looking forward to it.
I'm sure. Thanks very much for being with me today, Dr. Beckwith.
Thank you, Joe.
Stephen Beckwith is the former director of the Space Telescope Science Institute and a professor of physics and astronomy at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. This program is produced by Karen Vergoth, Charles Bergquist, and Marie Cunningham, and senior producer Annette Heist. Our director is Charles Bergquist. Our intern is Stephen Orns. Odette Youssef and Susan Lund worked the phones for us today. We have help today from Gwen Uten. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Suite 306, New York, New York, 10036. For internet mail, scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online, or take them with you as a podcast, and check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teachers using Science Friday. Just click on the teacher's link on sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.